This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abuhul, John McDonald, and the rest of the team.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And welcome to Talking of Books. And I've got a studio full of guests today. My name's Yvette Judge, and I'm joined by my co-host, Hend Saeed. Hend, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, Hend has literally leapt out of bed, leapt in her car and raced to the studio because we need to send John McDonald, who should be here, our best wishes because he should have been in the studio with me today, but he's sick. So thank you, Hend. And you're looking as gorgeous as ever, even if you have just raced out of bed.
Thank you.
And much appreciated. And later in the programme, I'm going to be welcoming Setu, and we'll be talking about the first book that we've got this morning, When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. But first of all, in case some of you think that maybe the Litfest's gone a bit quiet, you haven't had any emails from us or anything like that, we've got trouble at the office, haven't we, Hend? It's not been an easy week. So we're doing a little bit of a move so that we are all regrouping into one building, which that's fine. That's all happening.
It'll be nice.
Hen's got lots of friends now. She's got a big table with all her programming team.
And all the books around us.
So that's been hard work. But then we sadly have lost our internet and phone connection. Now, in a way, that's a joy because it's like, whoa, no one can email me. And then you go home and open the laptop. And that's a scary moment, actually. So if communications from us by phone and email are a little bit slow, that's why. But Atisala are working on it for us, and I'm sure we'll be up and running next week. So lots of interesting happenings in the office last week, and lots of moves still to happen. But hopefully everybody will be content with their new place of work, their new desk, and everybody seems to be taking their own chairs, although there was a bit of chair theft going on this weekend. I don't know if you noticed that. Yeah.
I didn't notice
no,
that.
No, there was a bit of, that chair's better than mine. I'm going to do a swap while nobody's looking.
I think because programming team already settled.
Correct.
Happy in our office.
programming team, Hendy's a member of that team, are extremely happy because they've managed to steal all the best chairs and seem quite content. So that's where we are in Litfest land. And it's been quite a busy time. It's been Abu Dhabi Book Fair, and we'll be talking to Hend a little bit later in the programme with some more updates on that. But you've spent quite a bit of time there, haven't you?
Yes, I spent actually two long days there, definitely, from Abu Dhabi Book Fair. It was really interesting. A large number of publishers and authors at the same time, and activities. It was really, really nice. And we like some certain things, like they have the illustrators corner, where you go and see like five or six illustrator working. So it was really, really nice to have, and children authors. And we met very good authors at that time, yeah.
Excellent. So that was happening, that finished last week, didn't it? So
yes.
Hend takes care of the Arabic side of the programme, and we're introducing a new feature. You'll be hearing Hend's voice lots more on air in the coming weeks because we're going to have a little Arabic feature every week.
Yes, and thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
Give us this opportunity to talk about Arabic books and Arabic books in translation also, that so people can read them in English, or sometimes are books that are not translated, but just to give an idea about the Arabic authors and what they write.
No, that's
Arabic
brilliant.
Literature in general.
I mean, when we did a programme last year, which somewhat bizarrely had me and Isabel talking about Arabic literature, which yes, we do read it in translation, but neither of us read it in the original. And we had so many messages and so many words of appreciation for doing that we thought we should make it a regular feature. So, Hend, that's your Saturday morning's gone.
Yes, it's gone. It will be interesting. And I met someone, a very old friend in Abu Dhabi Book Fair, and he actually listened to Talking Books, and he was very interested that we are starting Arabic books also on that.
Great.
So, I mean, a lot of Arabic speakers do... listen to that.
That's right.
So it will be great.
Yeah, excellent. So that's one of our new features that's going to be coming up. I'm going to introduce our first guest this morning. In fact, I'm going to ask her to introduce herself. Setu, welcome. A regular on Talking of Books, although I haven't shared a studio with you for a while. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Good morning. Well, it's always such a pleasure to be on Talking of Books, particularly because I'm reading all the time. And it's a great forum for me to sort of share my excitement about a book, what inspired me, what I liked, and sometimes what I didn't like. I've been with Talking of Books for a few years now. This is the fourth or fifth time I'm here. And I've always loved my association with the Lit Fest as well. For, I think, 4 years, I was consecutively, I was a moderator. Then travel sort of came in the way. But I've enjoyed my time with the Lit Fest and with the radio show so much. And thank you for inviting me back. I'm so happy to be here.
Absolute pleasure. So have you stopped traveling quite so much now? Are you back with us?
Thank you.
You're back in Dubai, not traveling, or?
Yes, back in Dubai, still traveling, but it's. I think there is more order to my travel now. It's not like, you know, just take off tomorrow kind of stuff.
So
I know when
it.
I'm here and when I'm not.
Excellent. Well, very nice to have you with us. Now, you've chosen a very interesting book. I noticed this morning the paperback version is just out, I think.
I believe
and
so,
it's,
yes.
And it's already in the non-fiction charts at number 10. The hardback, when it came out, was in the charts for a long, long time. So introduce us to the book. What's it called?
Sure. The book is When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanidhi. It's pronounced Kalanidhi. I know that because he's from that part of India where I come from. But his parents moved to America and he was born there. So he's a naturalized American. So the book was published in January 2016 and went straight to the top of the New York Times bestsellers list and stayed there for over 50 weeks continuously. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for 2017 in the category Biographies and Autobiographies. And interestingly, the book was published posthumously 10 months after the author, 37-year-old Dr. Paul Kalanidhi, succumbed to metastatic lung cancer. Dr. Paul Kalanidhi was born in 77, and interestingly, after finishing school, he went on to do his BA and MA in English Literature and a BSc in Human Biology from Stanford University. So I think he was on the cusp of, I can't decide, do I do just literature or do I go into sciences? Then he went on to the University of Cambridge in Britain, where he read history and the philosophy of science and medicine for his master's degree there. And then there was this turnaround, father, doctor, I think another brother was doing medicine, and he thought his calling was in medicine. And he joined the school, he went to the Yale School of Medicine to, you know, graduate as a doctor, and then chose the toughest of residency programs, neurosurgery, at the Stanford School of Medicine for his postdoctoral fellowship as well. So this is sort of the background on Dr. Paul Kalanidhi. The book opens with a trainee surgeon examining a set of images from a CT scan. His highly trained eye takes in how the tumors are dispersed across the lungs, how the spine is deformed, how one lobe of the liver has been obliterated. The diagnosis is straightforward: cancer widely disseminated. The only one thing that makes this case different from the dozens he deals with each week, these are scans of his own body.
Wow.
So
yeah, it's a fairly gripping opening to a book. And I think what you were saying about his background with literature shines very clearly through the book. And I think one of the beauties of the American system is actually you can do that. You can study something completely different at university. So he's got the biology, he's got the science, he's also got the literary side. Obviously, he didn't go to any second-rate institutions either. He just went straight for the top in all of them. Extremely intelligent man.
Yes.
And the book is beautifully written. I think the fact that he is an English literature major shines through.
You know, when you think about the premise of the book and, you know, it's literally a memoir on dying, and you would think that this could be so depressing. But it is not. When you read the book, it is inspiring. It is sad. Definitely sad,
definitely sad.
You know the outcome, but it's not depressing because he is so alive to every moment that he's living that you cannot feel depressed when you read the book.
But it is very difficult to write a book when you know you're dying and you're writing about your death. That is really
absolutely. I mean, when this book was recommended to me and, you know, I knew what it was, I said, no, I'm not going to read it. It's just, I don't think I can read another book on death and cancer and things like that. But, you know, I'm part of a book club, and we had done another book called The Biology of Belief. And one of the, our book club members is a doctor, and she said, no, 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 the science is all wrong. I will bring in a book that the science is good and right. And she recommended this book. And when it comes for your book club, you jolly well have to read it. You cannot make excuses.
True. I mean, I have to say, I've seen it in the bestseller list a lot, and obviously I'm trying to keep up with what's going on there. And it's a book that I've probably looked at about eight times, because I think sometimes I have the retention of a goldfish. I'm thinking, oh, I must check what that is. And then I read again, I'm like, no, not going to do that.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, thank you for making me get over that and making me read it. I'm not sure I could say I actually enjoyed it. Because, I don't know, it's a very difficult book to read. It's a very emotional book to read. You know it's real. You know it's true. It's not a story. It's non-fiction. It is uplifting. And I think to share what he's going through does have a profound effect on the reader.
Yes.
I would never, honestly, I would never have chosen to read this book. As I say, I didn't enjoy it. I don't think that would be the right word, but I'm glad I read it.
Right, yes.
There's definitely a difference.
There's a big difference.
It's certainly not my preferred genre.
Correct, yes.
But thank you for making me engage with it.
No, the praise for this book has been phenomenal.
It has been.
I'd just like to read this. I mean, like New York Times, Janet Maslin, she writes, I guarantee that finishing this book and then forgetting about it is simply not an option.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. We're going to come back very shortly and hear more about When Breath Becomes Air.
This is Talking of Books here on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. And we are having a look at When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. And I quite like to just have a little snip of Paul talking about the book and himself.
Having to face my own mortality and the idea that I was going to die in an acute way, because when I first saw my scan, you know, I thought I did not have very long left for this world.
And what he's...
Ooh, so that really sets the tone for the book, doesn't it, Setu? It's, as we said, it's not an easy read. It's a very quick read. I think the book is 200 pages.
That's about it, yes. It's not a big book, but it's not easy to read because you're constantly evaluating your life, your priorities. You are constantly facing your own mortality, because he keeps saying that that's the only definite thing that you're moving towards. And not a pleasant thought first thing on a Saturday morning, but...
when I was reading it at 6 o'clock this morning, I must admit.
But this is life, isn't it?
Yes. It is. I think for me what resonated in the book also is his approach to medicine and why he was so good at what he did.
A perfectionist.
Yes.
Absolutely, yes.
But also how much he cares about
humanity.
And the patients and the people with them. And he talks about, as a doctor, his first encounters when someone dies, when they're in your care. And the difficulties of those first placements in the hospital when you are making literally life and death decisions.
Life and death decisions. You're right.
Do you feel qualified to do them? Mm. You're tired. You've worked for 36 hours and you're still being made to make those decisions. And I think any of us who've had dealings with healthcare, whether it's as a patient, as a parent, as anyone, family members, friends who are sick, I think that really resonates. Well, certainly with me and things that he talked about that I thought, gosh, yes. You know, I can remember being when my mum was diagnosed with cancer and sitting in a room with my two sisters and the doctor. Now, my mum was 67. Okay, I don't think that's terribly old. And he said, you know, we need to look at the treatment because of her age. What do you mean because of her age? It's like, she's 60. That, just like, why would a doctor ever say that? Whatever he's thinking, whatever might be the reality, why on earth would you say that to a patient? So for me, I think the thing that resonated with the book was definitely how he deals with the people in his care, and not just the patients, but the families.
Absolutely. I mean, he calls it a calling. Not a job. If he wanted a job, he'd probably, you know, he would have taken a specialization in radiology or something where you have decent working hours, you look at a few scans and you go home evening for your game of golf and, you know, dinner at home. But no, I think his personality is such. In fact, he showed exceptional excellence, so much so that towards the end of the book, he has job offers which are, you can only dream about, because he qualifies as a chief resident in neurosurgery, and that is one of the most difficult disciplines in medicine. And this diagnosis of cancer came at such a difficult time for him. All of 37 years or 36 years old, verge of qualifying as a neurosurgeon, almost a decade of intense training, and he finds himself not only confronting terminal illness, but also an identity crisis. He's been the doctor, now he's the patient. Where does he stand? He continues to be a doctor while he's being a patient for his oncologist. It's very, very tough, and he writes about it very movingly, because until his illness, his life had been one of relentless striving and exceptional excellence. He chose the most demanding specialization, drawn to it by its, he calls it, unforgiving call to perfection. He worked 100 hours a week doing operations where the difference between success and failure was a matter of millimeters. Yeah. You know, on his striving for perfection, he says in the book, "You can't ever reach perfection, but you can believe in an asymptote towards which you are ceaselessly striving." I mean, this striving throughout, I found that it was this striving that almost ruined his marriage. Yes. You know, Yvette? Just before the diagnosis, his wife is ready to walk out on him to say that this marriage is not working, we need counselling.
But that's partly because he didn't share with her. He knew there was something wrong. He'd obviously had symptoms. He's a doctor.
He's
aware that it could be the worst possible diagnosis.
You know, all that was happening to him.
And he didn't share it with her. He didn't. And I think...
And his hours. I mean, she was a resident as an internist, where she had sensible working hours. And here this man was doing straight 36-hour stretches of, surgery. Possibly, I don't know, we are not doing marriage counselling here, but there were difficulties.
There were, and, he addresses those.
I know.
For sure, in the book.
And his wife, actually, she came out and said, "I was initially not happy that went into the book." But she says, I think, for the authenticity of what he was saying, it needed to be there, because we have to face our demons whether we like them or not.
Absolutely. I also think it's quite interesting that the shift he observed from being the medical practitioner to being the patient.
To being the patient,
and
yes.
How we've experienced medical appointments when you come out thinking, oh, for goodness sake, why didn't I ask that? And you sit there and you just nod, take it all in, and then you walk out thinking, why?
Exactly.
And for him to acknowledge that.
Yes, the why me?
Yeah.
And that's the first
thing.
The why thing, me? You know, the why me?
Yeah.
You go through that, you feel, you know, the victim feeling, that why me? And particularly at his age of 36, the why me is going to be seriously a big question.
And a doctor also.
Absolutely.
So he knows what's healthy, what's not healthy, and all
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And his diagnosis comes when he's at his fourth stage. So maybe because he had this fit physical body, whatever the symptoms would have sort of come up with others didn't show up at all. So he says that before my cancer was diagnosed, because he says receiving the diagnosis changes everything and nothing. Before my cancer was diagnosed, I knew that someday I would die, but I didn't know when. After the diagnosis, I knew that someday I would die, but I still didn't know when. Yet your mind that has shifted completely. You know, you're looking at a very finite timeline now.
I'd like to shift slightly, if I may, and give our listeners the chance to maybe win a book. Possibly not the one we're talking about, but certainly a signed copy of a book by one of the 2017 Litfest authors. And I know exactly where they all are now in the office. They're in my room behind my desk. So I know just what we've got. So it's quite an easy question, I think. I tested it on my husband this morning, although he is a scientist, so he should have known. The title of the book that we're discussing is When Breath Becomes Air. And I would like you to text in and tell us which gas forms the major part of what we call air? It's a very easy question, I think. And please SMS your answers to 4001. And don't forget to tell us your name for the chance to win a copy of a LitFest book. So which gas forms the major part of what we call air? I might do a bonus point for anybody who can tell me the percentage, but I might now I've got control of the books. People are going to regret this. I may chuck an extra book in. Somebody can tell us what that percentage is. 4001. Looking forward to hearing from you. So we are being uplifted. We're being moved by this book, even though we know what happens at the end.
Yes, we do. Yes, from the beginning. In fact, Abraham Verghese, another doctor who writes the prologue to the book, he says if you are holding this book in your hand, you know what has already happened, what the book is about. But yet, the book reads like a meditation. The language is so beautiful. In fact, Dr. Abraham Verghese brings out that he felt it was almost like poetry in prose. There is a rhythm to the writing, and I was absolutely hooked because some of the descriptions, not the medical descriptions, but in a way he talks about his early experiences before all this happened, they're just so beautiful, so well written. And I think, as you said, his training in English literature, and his first love was literature, all of that sort of just came in. And in fact, in one place he says that, this is a very interesting quote, in which he says that the good news is I've already outlived two Brontes, Keats and Stephen Crane. The bad news is that I haven't written anything.
that's excellent. Actually.
Because he always wanted to write as well as being a doctor.
Yeah. You know. And that's one of those things you have to acknowledge, that sometimes you need to do it now, not say, I'll do it next year.
Absolutely, yeah.
And
nothing like the present.
We're going to just vanish for a moment and we'll be back very, very soon.
This is Talking of Books here on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And welcome back to Talking of Books. And at the moment we are talking about a book called When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. And we're joined in the studio by Setu, who has obviously been very, very moved by this book. Before we go on with that, just a quick reminder of the question where you can win a copy of a LitFest signed book. The question is very, very simple, and we've got quite a few right answers coming in already. Some of you are obviously paying attention in your chemistry lessons, or even biology, actually. So, which gas forms the major part of what we call air? Can you tell me the gas? And I may do a bonus prize if you can tell me the percentage of that particular gas in what we breathe in the air. And thank you. Obviously, some of you are quite intrigued by this book and quite enjoying it. So this book sounds amazing and could be life-changing. And I would agree, because I certainly think it makes you, as we were saying before, think about what you want to do tomorrow. And actually, should you do it tomorrow or should you do it now?
Do it now.
Do it now.
Be in the present.
Absolutely. So all your random unplanned travel, see?
Right.
So if I'm not in the office tomorrow,
you know, you're in Bhutan.
I'm travelling.
If Hendon and I decide that there's something we urgently need to do and we can't put off, we may make a few plans later in the show. But it does make you think, and that for me is the beauty of books like this.
Absolutely.
It makes you literally stop in your tracks.
Exactly.
And you know, that terrible moment when, and he had an awareness, obviously, he's a doctor, he's had all the symptoms, but to actually be told straight out, this is what you've got, here are the scans.
Yes, and you know, interestingly, as soon as sort of he got his diagnosis and everything was confirmed, he starts to obsess about statistics and survival curves. And in the book, his oncologist puts him in his place. He says, no, I'm not going to discuss this with you. You're fine, because he's a healthy young man. He's all of 36. Mm-hmm. And he realizes that while statistics might help a doctor to decide on the course of treatment, like you were mentioning, this is what they sort of, you know, they depending on the age as they speak, based on expected outcomes, it is of no relevance to the patient. And
exactly.
I quote from the book, what patients seek is not scientific knowledge that doctors hide, but existential authenticity each person must find on his or her own. The angst of facing mortality has no remedy in probability. I was telling you, the language is just so beautiful. And then in the absence of any certainty, he decides that he can, you know, that all he can do is assume he's going to live for a long, long time. So once the drugs kick in and his symptoms subside, he puts on his scrubs and he heads back to the operating theatre. And not only that, he and his wife Lucy embark on fertility treatments, IVF actually, because they want to have a child. And Lucy says, "Don't you think saying goodbye to your child would make your death more painful?" And his answer is, "Wouldn't it be great if it did?" Well, this is the beauty of this human being who lived, and the way he thought. And they actually have the baby, and soon after that he reaches a point where no more chemo, no more medicines, and actually he dies when the baby is 7 months old. But at the end of the book, he writes this absolutely beautiful message to this child to say that you will never realize what you have meant to me, to a dying man, the fact that you are there. I think this is the point when you just break down and you sob and cry, you know.
Yeah, can I just say, this is not a book to read in public.
No, it's not a book.
I've made that mistake before with other books and had very worried looks cast in my direction. So for me, this is a book that should be read.
As I said, it is like a meditation. It is truly like a meditation, because through his life, you view your life through a different set of lenses that this book really brings out to you. And you take a different perspective on life and on your decisions. So many things. I don't know if a week down you're going to be thinking about this book, but at that time, somewhere, something has clicked in your mind, in your brain, and you're not going to look at your life the same way as you did before you read the book.
Unfortunately, I think people don't think about their life until something happened like that. And that's where we think, okay, I need to do that, I need to do that.
Exactly.
And also it says in one of the reviews, it says between hope and accepting death. I mean, a book about that. And
yes.
Do you think it will be suitable for people who are facing something like that to read a book and to know how they can face their illness? Or
You mean if someone is facing terminal illness?
Terminal illness.
My advice is yes. I would think so, because here is a first-hand experience of someone who came to terms with life and his mortality. So I think it would help. I mean, I don't know, but I think it would help.
Yeah, because it's a very, very difficult situation that you need to face and
need
to be very strong.
Because, you know, there's been high praise for this book, and it's been a runaway success. And in fact, the publishers were very surprised with its success. Because, you know, they did not expect such a reception, because there's no feel-good factor. Because he didn't overcome his illness. There's no feel-good factor in that sense.
There's no obvious happy ending.
Exactly. It's not there.
As we say, you know what's going to happen from the outset.
From the outset.
But he's got the legacy that he's leaving behind, not just with his daughter, but also actually by writing the book. And it's the existentialist argument that, you know, what... in order to continue, we have to leave something behind. And I think he's writing in this book his thoughts and also what he's done as a doctor and the empathy he feels with his patients. I think that's what he's leaving behind.
His own sort of spiritual journey is here, because raised in a Catholic home, you know, church going and, you know, whatever else is there, he turns away and literally becomes an atheist, because he says science has the answer to everything. But then, you know, once when his wife, actually in an interview I read this, she asked him, "Do you believe in God?" He didn't answer. Instead, he asked her, "Do you believe in love? If someone asked me that, my answer would be yes. And therefore, now I believe in God as well." And he went back to his faith.
Yes, which I think is very common, isn't it? And I think when we're faced with the end... What do we go back to?
What do we want?
What do we...
Exactly.
What beliefs do we...
But then
find?
He writes again and again that his reading of the scripture changed, because he realized that you're not supposed to take the literal meaning.
So there's a whole exploration of that.
Of that.
In 200 pages, he packs in an awful lot. And I think,
doesn't he? Yes.
I think you feel you know him. You know, you can read a novel or a biography, autobiography of 500 pages and not feel that you know the person as well as you know Paul after these 200 pages of
absolutely
beautiful prose. If it were a novel, if it were poetry, it would definitely be a prize winner for the actual language. As it is, it's non-fiction, so it's,
yes,
as you say,
I
it was
know
nominated for the Pulitzer.
Pulitzer, yes. And it was a finalist. And another book made it, but this was a finalist, which is pretty close, I think, because there's so many books that are on the list.
Absolutely.
And, I think this, coming back to what you were saying, definitely I would feel that it would help. Because it is very sad. As I said, my friend of mine read it overnight and she sobbed all the way. So, but she went back to read it again. Because the first time it was extremely emotional. But the second time, it happened to me as well. I read it the first time and then when I read it again, the rhythm, the language, the beauty of the words, the choice of expressions that he's got. And I think you read more into what kind of a human being he was.
Yes,
I and
agree.
His authenticity, his honesty throughout the book, it touches you. It really does.
Many books deserve a second reading, and I think with this one, obviously,
if you've liked it the first time, you should go back.
I agree, because you're reading it for the story. You want to know what happens to him.
Exactly.
And then the second time through, well, you do know what happens, but you want to know that journey. The second time when you read it, you know there, you've got the picture and you are focused very much on the beauty of the words that he uses. And he's not only a sad loss to medicine, but definitely a sad loss to writing.
Yes.
And I think he could have become a great novelist and a great poet.
You know, he had his, 40 years ahead, he had planned his life.
Yeah.
You know, and then finally, you know, someone like him was brilliant and he knows where he's headed. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He knows where he's headed, his neurosurgery, chief residency, hospital, his own research lab, all of that came to him. And then suddenly, none of these plans matter anymore.
Yeah, how many times have we
heard
that?
Speaking of his ambitions, which he had to set aside, once he received the diagnosis of terminal illness, he writes in the book, most ambitions are either achieved or abandoned. Either way, they belong to the past. The future, instead of the ladder towards the goals of life, flattens out into the perpetual present.
So today we're having a look at a book which ultimately could be seen as an extremely depressing book. It's When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi.
Yes.
We know what's going to happen at the end. It's a non-fiction book.
Yes.
However, I think we've all agreed that why it may not for me have been necessarily an enjoyable read. It's a book that I'm very glad I've read. It's a very uplifting book. And I can see why, certainly, it's in the top 10. It's been the top 10 internationally with the hardback and now with the paperback.
With the paperback as well.
And widely available and widely praised. I mean, it has got excellent reviews.
Excellent reviews, absolutely. And I just sort of, you know, when his wife writes the epilogue and she writes this about him, I just wanted to share this. She says that he faced each stage of his illness with grace. Not bravado, not like, oh, I will overcome, this is nothing, I'll kick it out. No. But with an authenticity that allowed him to grieve the loss of the future he had planned and forge a new one. I think this is a fitting sort of end to his life, because this comes from his wife, and the only thing he asked of her on his deathbed was, please get this book published, because it was still in the sort of writing draft stage. And she was asked to write the epilogue 2 months after he died. And it's a beautifully written piece at the end of the book.
I haven't delved into how the book actually ended up being finished. Have you looked at that set? Did he have an editor who came and actually did the final?
Yes, at Random House. Yes, they'd already, I think, sold the rights to Random House. And the editor came in and I think they have to sort of polish up the...
Yes,
You know, there's never, like Jeffrey Archer said at the Litfest, the 17th time you've gone through it, that's possibly when you should send it to the publishers.
This is true. This is true. So, yes, well done to Random House for taking that on and for spotting what an incredible book it was going to be.
Yes.
And... I guess I think he wanted his wife to remarry. I think that was also.
Yes, he wanted. And she says, I was not ready.
Mm.
I didn't even want to move out of the house. But well, now no. I believe she has moved. Mm-hmm. And it's over 2 years now,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
So she's ready to move on. And she should. She's a young woman. And I think, getting to know Paul the way after reading the book, he would have wanted her to move on and have a new life ahead
yes.
of her.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So that's our what could be depressing book, but actually isn't.
Isn't. I would say it isn't. Sad, yes, but not depressing.
It's a good lesson.
And you haven't actually read it. Have we made you want to read it, or is it one that you'll still
No, I
still
do want
from?
To read it. Really, I do want to read it.
It's small book. It won't take you long to read, but it's very moving. Very,
yes.
very moving.
It is, yes. So
thank you. No, thank
no
you
more
for that.
Shall I look at it on the bestseller list and go, no, not for me. But there's another one, Henry Marsh, surgeon, who did also a medical stories book, not quite in the same vein, but looking at the decisions that are made mm-hmm. in medicine, and he's got another one out. So there's obviously a great interest in at the moment mm. in that side of life, in medicine, how decisions are made, and literally
there
life
is another
and death
author, American author of Indian origin, Atul Gawande.
Oh, absolutely.
And
yes.
his Being Mortal
yes.
is a must read for everybody.
Yeah.
Whether
one
you
of
are
favorites.
In your 60s or 50s or yeah. you've got parents in that age.
That's right.
It's a must read.
We saw him at Jaipur Lit Fest last
you
year.
You did?
Yes.
He's amazing. He's
yeah.
very remarkable. He speaks well. He writes well. He's a medical doctor.
Yes,
very,
very. As I say,
this book in particular, Being Mortal, I would recommend it to everybody.
Oh, definitely one of Isabel's favourites. And we'll be back very, very soon. Stay listening.
From Agatha Christie to Jeffrey Archer, we've got it covered. Talking of books.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
On Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
And I'd just like to take the opportunity to thank Setu for her choice of book this week. Something very, very different for us. And you've obviously done your research. It's a book that you have loved, that's resonated with you. And thank you very much for sharing this with us and also sharing it with the listeners. And I think a lot of people will be going away to read this. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. So thank you very much for that find for us and making me actually read something from the bestsellers list and go, no, not for me. If anyone would like to message in to 4001 with your name and tell us what the major component of air is, there's a Litfest signed book to be won. And if you can tell us what percentage of air that particular gas is, there could be a bonus prize from one of the books that I've discovered lurking in the office. So, Setu, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you. I just love being on Talking Books, and thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And go away and do some more research. Find us some more good books, because I know you always come up with something interesting when you're book champion, rather than when we force you to read something, which we'll be coming up with Tick Hughes also in the studio later.
Yes.
So nice to have the listener's choice as well as our own. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Hend,
yes.
we've got a few book clubs happening, I believe, as part of the Litfest. Now, it's quite nice to have you here because you can tell us a little bit more about the Arabic Readers Club, because normally I stumble through that and I know very little, so I can actually just stop
Good,
talking and
help
over
with that.
To you. Tell us.
Well, the Festival Reading Group in Arabic, we meet once a month and we read an Arabic book. It's fiction or non-fiction, depending on which book we choose. And we meet at Sukoon Centre, which is in Jumeirah and Bustle Street, next to Umm Sukhaim Park. This month we have a meeting on Tuesday, 9th of May at 11 o'clock at Sukoon, and we're reading Tathrib by Sultan and Musa. Tathrib is actually a non-fiction book. It's Sultan Musa Young is Saudi authors who do study civilization and religions, and he started writing these books when someone asked him about his religion and Islam, and he didn't find the right answer, so he did a lot of research. It's a very interesting book, and he take us through, he done a lot of research in that book about civilizations and old beliefs and whether new beliefs and the religion. A very interesting way. Unfortunately, it's not translated to English yet. Yes.
So what does Tathrib mean?
Well, Tathrib is in a very old word.
Mm-hmm.
is very hard to... It's an area we're called Tathrib, actually, but the meaning of it, I'm not sure what it is, but the area in Saudi is called Tathrib, yeah.
Okay, thank you. So any listeners who read in Arabic, do look out. This is all on our website, all on Emirates Richard Foundation.
It is on our
website. You can find the information. And Sukkun, I have to say, is a beautiful place to be. It's literally between Awassal Road and the sea, and it's a little oasis of peace.
It's a very quiet place.
Yeah.
And a very nice outside area. When the weather is good, we actually sit outside in the garden. But when the weather is not that hot, I mean, it's not cold, then we sit inside. And and so on the website, you can register. There is an email if you like to come. So you can register and send an email to me. And we welcome anyone who wants to read, anyone who actually haven't read the book, although they can come and listen to the discussion, and then maybe next month can read. They can find on the website the three coming book for the 3 months, coming months, so people can choose if they want to come 1 month or not. We will stop in Ramadan in June. Mm-hmm. Because of the fasting, and we'll come back in July.
So this is our last one
before Ramadan, yes.
And elfdubai.org or emiratelitfest.com, either way you will be directed to the information on the Arabic reading group. And I know Hend would love to see you. How many people do you get each month, Hend?
Well, we get about between 6 to 10, depending on the people.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's a good, I mean, we don't want it to much too bigger also. Mm. That is difficult. Sometimes we have a big group than that. But it's an interesting discussion because you have different people from different backgrounds and different beliefs also, you can say. Yeah. So it's always very interesting.
Who chooses the books?
Well, I choose the books, but then also I get recommendation from people who read the books and they find it's good book, and then we can add these books also.
Yeah. Great. So, for our Arabic readers out there, do check that one out, Tathrib by Sultan Al-Musa, and the next reading group is on May the 9th at 11 a.m. and it's at Sukkun, which is in between our Wassel and the Beach Road, right by Sukkun Park. And Hend would love to see you, but you can send her an email, track that down via the website. If you need any more information, you can also just send us a quick SMS now to 4001 and we will get back to you with any questions on that. For people who read in lots of different languages, we also have the English Reader's Majlis. Have you ever been along to that one, Hend?
No, unfortunately, I haven't been to that.
See, this happening working, the working, I'm going to have to go
hours.
To this. I know Gillian's been. That happens at the Sofitel JBR. And the next one of those is May the 8th at 10 o'clock. And that one takes a theme.
Yes.
So you can take along any book, I think in any language, that fits the theme. And that really is a multilingual book group, but I think the conversation happens in English. So the next theme is how our roots influence our flowers, the presence of our background in our daily life. I really like that topic, and if only I were free on May the 8th, I'd go along to that.
Yes, I mean, I heard there's a lot of good discussions there, because as you said, people coming from different, read the books in different languages, so everyone bring their information, their knowledge, and then they all speak English at that time, but they maybe read the book in French, Italian, Arabic, or any other things. I heard there's a lot of really good discussion, good knowledge also, you know, some people see books yet you never read because it's a language that you don't read
and
it's not translated.
So that's a great one again. And if you're free in the evenings and you'd like to join the festival reading group, Annabelle from our team runs that, and the next one is on May the 17th at 7:30, and that one's happening at the World Trade Centre Club on the 33rd floor of the Sheikh Rashid Tower. And the book on the 17th is Swim Among the Stars by Kanish Tharoor.
Well, I promised her I will read the book this time and
excellent
and go.
Any younger readers out there can join me once a month for the children's reading group, which happens at Costa at Arabian Ranches. And the one for May the 20th, Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, is Beetle Boy by M.G. Leonard. M.G. Leonard is quite a new talent in writing for young people. Beetle Boy is great. Beetle Boy will change the way you think about those insects that we maybe find a little bit unpleasant sometimes. So do give that one a try. Vital that you register for that, because otherwise we are overwhelmed with numbers. And again, details on the website. You'd be if you go on to elftoby.org and or emirateslitfest.com, you will be directed to the correct place to register for that. So lots and lots of book reading going on in Dubai, and that's just a sample of what we are doing. So do try and join us for one of those wonderful, wonderful events. And one more thing from me, because we're also going to start having a look at books for younger readers too. So my picture book for the week is by Neil Gaiman, and it's called Cinnamon. And for me, the illustrations in this are stunning. It's by an illustrator I do not know called Divya Srinivasan. And it's sort of, I don't know, what is it, Jungle Book meets, you know, Just So Stories. It's that wonderful, wonderful style of colourful illustration, stunning, and a Neil Gaiman story. So Cinnamon is the little girl in it. Her eyes were pearls, which gave her great beauty, but meant she was blind. Her world was the colour of pearls, pale white and pink and softly glowing. So again, someone who is very, very gifted with his words, Neil Gaiman, and that's his latest book, Cinnamon. Have a look for that one. That's by Bloomsbury, and that is literally just out. So we've had a lot of reading clubs. We've had a great book recommendation from Setu. Thank you very much. And we've finished there with a picture book, and I think we might be going to have a look at a book for younger readers in the next segment of the show. So stay listening.
This is Talking of Books here on Dubai Eye 103.8.